It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
Hello and welcome to the show today. We have a fantastic show for you today. We're going to have a lot of fun. Well, we're going to be going back and forth between Gordon Sondland, who is on C-SPAN, and we'll give you the scoop on what's happening as he's testifying. His testimony actually began at 9 a.m. this morning, and I've been listening on and off throughout the morning, and he opened. So let me tell you who's going to be on the show. Luann de Lesseps, formerly known as the Countess and still may be referred to that way. Luann de Lesseps, who grew up in Berlin, Connecticut, believe it or not, in Berlin, Connecticut. She is going to be on our show at 11:30 this morning because she's going to be at the Richfield Playhouse soon. So we'll hear all about that. And also coming on the show today is a guest, Dr. Julian Ford, somebody that I was so impressed with. I saw a presentation of his about the symptoms of trauma, particularly the symptoms of trauma in children. In other words, when you're around children, whether you're a teacher or a camp counselor or a therapist or just generally speaking in your life, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, or children of your own, how to recognize the symptoms that the child may have been exposed to trauma and carry, and how the child carries those symptoms throughout their lives. And the ways in which we can recognize them then give us some insight into how to help people. And I was just so impressed with Dr. Ford's presentation that I asked him to come on the show. So we're going to be talking about how we recognize trauma and how we treat trauma, both in children and adults. And also, we'll have some fun as we chat with Luann de Lesseps. And this is a woman who's had her share of hardships. She was publicly intoxicated. She was charged with a lot of crimes down in Florida. I believe she's still on probation. And her life has been exposed because she has voluntarily exposed it on television as a reality star. So we'll get into a little bit of why she's doing that, what she gets out of it. Has it been good or bad for her? And also, of course, her burgeoning cabaret career. And she's coming to the Richfield Playhouse in Connecticut. I think the date is December 6th, but I don't want to get it wrong. I know it's coming up soon. And we want her to have a sold-out house, and we want you to support her because she happens to also be a dear friend of my sister, Jill. And so I know Luann since the very beginning, which I believe now is something like 12 or 13 years ago. It's hard to believe. So anyway, Luann and I go back quite a ways in this adventure of the Real Housewives of New York City. 203-333-9422 is our number. It is 9 minutes after 10 o'clock. 203-333-9422 as we get started. So what should we talk about first? Should we talk about the Democrats' new proposal to... Now, this is coming not from the... This is not coming from Senator Martin Looney. This is coming from the House Democrats. So we've got four different bodies within our legislature, as well as the governor. Think about it as five different organizations or entities or people that need to weigh in. The governor, obviously, with his proposal, and his was a $21.9 billion proposal to overhaul transportation here in Connecticut. Martin Looney signaling on behalf of the Senate majority Democrats that that wasn't going to fly. The Republican minority Senate, Len Fasano, coming up with a counter proposal that didn't include tolls at all. And now we hear, as we make our way through this progress, that the House Democrats have countered with a proposal that says, you know what, we really don't like tolls for cars, but we are willing to toll trucks. So what do you think about that? 203-333-9422. What do you think about the idea of tolling trucks? This was the plan that was offered yesterday to Governor Lamont. The concept was, according to the Connecticut Mirror, welcomed by Martin Looney and said some members of our caucus would favor that. Lamont praised the House Democrats for reviving the approach that shares two of his goals. Number one, giving a dedicated revenue source, which is the tolls, but also tapping out-of-state drivers. Now, remember, Governor Lamont, as a candidate, had originally promised, I'm not going to propose tolls, but wait. Okay, I'll propose them for trucks. And then when he became governor, he said, no, I'm going to propose them for everybody. So he's appreciative. Everyone's talking nicely. House Speaker Joe Arasemowitz and House Majority Leader Matt Ritter say their plan would raise between $100 to $115 million annually. That's less than half the $230 million that Lamont wanted to raise by tolling everybody. But last week, the Senate Republican minority proposed using a bunch of the state's budget reserves in the rainy day fund to pay down existing pension liabilities. And by saving that money, saving other money in interest that the state has to pay on those pension liabilities, and then carving $130 million and putting that right back into the budget. So here's my question. If the Republicans can figure out a way to save us from spending $130 million a year to banks and put that money instead into transportation, and the Democrat proposal only raises, at a best guess, between $100 and $150 million, so right in the sweet spot of $130 million, why would we go to Connecticut taxpayers, to Connecticut residents, to the people who will overwhelmingly pay the proportion of tolls? Why are we going back to the Connecticut taxpayers and insisting on tolling them when it's the exact same amount of money that can be raised in the Republican budget? 203-333-9422. There are possibly constitutional aspects that may be challenged by the truckers if they are the only ones being charged. Patrick Sasser is a leader of No Tolls Connecticut. He said that he has the same problem with public trust that he's always had, and he believes it's sort of a foot in the door or the camel's nose under the door approach, that if we allow tolls to trucks today, then it's so easy once the public, once the overpasses are built, once the infrastructure is in place, once we have a tolling authority that is already collecting tolls, it will be so easy to say, oops, our budget is a little bit behind this year. Let's expand tolling to cars as well. And let's keep raising it and raising it and raising it. So with the theory of the camel under the nose under the tent, Patrick Sasser in No Tolls Connecticut says that this is a no-go. It's 203-333-9422 at 13 minutes after 10 o'clock. What say you on the tolls? You know, I was looking up another aspect of this, because one of the things we know, and we've heard this from many different experts on the subject, is that the low-hanging fruit to collect money is actually an increase in the way stations for commercial traffic, and also an increase in the personnel that actually weigh the trucks. And I was looking it up, and actually this is available online with a click of a button, because the reports are published every 6 months. And you can just go online and see exactly how many we have at the present. We have 6 weigh stations, and you can see how much, how many fines are collected from different weigh stations. There's a Greenwich weigh station. There's a Waterford weigh station, mostly obviously on 95. And I think last year we collected a little less than $2 million in fines. What does that mean? That means that trucks are not being honest about the weight of the loads that they are bringing in on the roads. And obviously the heavier the truck, the more they should pay for it, because the more damage it could do to our roads. So that's another, I mean, so many people have said maybe it's not going to raise $100 million a year, but it will raise something if we do a better job at collecting the fines from the commercial truckers who are, you know, violating our rules with respect to how much weight they're supposed to have on Connecticut roads. At 14 minutes after the hour, 203-333-9422. Okay, I'm going to segue a little bit. So first we're talking about tolls, and what do you think of the Democrat plan to toll only trucks? Call me at 203-333-9422. And then the other headline story today from the Norwalk Hour, we've spoken about this a little earlier this week, the concern about these see-through rails. These see-through rails that are in the Sono collection and the glass railing, and how one mother already posted on Facebook that she was afraid of allowing her 2.5-year-old to play too close to the wall. Well, frankly, no 2.5-year-old should be able to play too close. She was saying, they warned me not to allow my 2.5-year-old to play too close to where the joint is, you know, meeting on the wall itself. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, well, that's just common sense. But the mall railing altogether is of concern to a lot of people. According to the Norwalk Hour, which repeated this Facebook posting that was originally from Stamford, the Fairfield County photos were posted on the Fairfield County CT Community Events Facebook page. Photos were posted depicting teenage children with furniture positioned next to the guardrails and using spinning top seats nearby. But the mall's developer says it is not going to reexamine the design of the rail or the layout of the nearby furnishings. They say that it is completely safe and it is in accordance with all laws. Let's go to Jeff from Shelton. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show today. Hello. What's on your mind today?
Well, listening to you told, you may or may not be aware that Rhode Island has been sued by the trucking industry for segregating out trucks for tolls.
I was not aware. So tell me about it, Jeff. What do you know about it?
Well, from my understanding, they were told they were tolling 18-wheelers, any six-wheeler type trucks. And I'm not sure if it's the Teamsters or who it was, but it was an organization that includes these trucks. And they went after Rhode Island. I wasn't following the results of it, but I did happen to hear it on the radio.
So so does that make you think that if we go ahead and institute this policy, we're just inviting a lawsuit from truckers? Is that your point?
Absolutely.
Do you like the idea altogether? If there wasn't a lawsuit, do you think that it's a fair way to go ahead and apportion tolling? What do you think of the idea?
Personally, not very good. My feeling is these truckers handle the product service of providing service for retailers, wholesalers, bottom line products. And that means that if that toll goes into effect, they're going to pass that through to the end user, which is us.
Yeah. And do you have an issue with the sort of the trust component of the whole thing?
In reality, not really. But what is fair is fair. I'm not for tolls.
Okay.
On the whole, I've seen it on major highways. We had it in on 95 way back when. They reduced them. My feeling is I think the state should just reduce their expenditures and not start picking on what they're doing, but overall the management of Connecticut.
I thank you very much, Jeff. I'm going to give you and others who are listening the scoop on the Rhode Island trucking lawsuit. So here we go. And I thank you for the call, Jeff. The American Trucking Association, Cumberland Farms, and M&M Transport Services sued in July of 2018. They contested whether or not the trucks-only tolls were constitutional. They alleged that it discriminated against interstate commerce because if a state charged a user fee for access to, quote, channels of interstate commerce, then they thought that it was basically... they made an allegation that it was discriminatory between in-state and out-of-state, and also, I guess, on the idea that they were just commercial. But the U.S. District Court of Rhode Island dismissed the suit in March. The trucking plaintiffs have appealed, but the dismissal was a victory for the Rhode Island Department of Transportation. And they said that the Tax Injunction Act restricted the power of federal district courts to prevent the collection or enforcement of state taxes. They also invoked the 11th Amendment. And so... they won on the first round. It's not to say that we would win in Connecticut, but we might. There's precedent. And thus far, the truck tolls in Rhode Island have collected in their first full year of operation $7.2 million. So it's hardly the $100 to $150 million that the House Democrats are expecting will happen. But on the other hand, I'm not sure how many gantries they had. I'm not sure, you know, how the House Democrats have made their expectation of what the revenue will be. But nonetheless, in Rhode Island, after having truck-only tolls for a year, they collected about $7.2 million in tolls. It's 20 minutes after the hour, 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show. We've got Countess Luann de Lesseps from the Real Housewives of New York City coming on the show. We also have Dr. Julian Ford, who will be on the show. And, of course, you'll be on the show as you continue to call, and we will continue to take your calls right here on the Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned. WICC 600, 203-333-9422. Hola, and welcome back to the show. Coming up at 11:30, we'll chat with Luann de Lesseps, who actually grew up in Berlin, Connecticut. She's a Connecticut girl, and she comes back to her roots, and she will be performing at the Ridgefield Playhouse soon to do her entire cabaret act. And she's had great success in what is either the 12th or the 13th season of The Real Housewives of New York City. I can't keep up. And we'll go to a more serious but really important conversation with Dr. Julian Ford in just a few minutes. And we'll be talking about how we can recognize the signs and symptoms of trauma. And if we see those signs and symptoms, how can we help people? How can we help children? Let's go to Jean from Stratford. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today, and thank you for calling. Hi, Jean.
Good morning, Lisa. And first, I just want to I'm very impressed with your knowledge and all the facts you've gathered on this whole toll situation. It's one of the best discussions that you carry on about it. And the point that I wanted to make, too, when you get onto the subject about the trucks, you got to remember that if tolls or some type of fee is charged to the trucks for using our roads, that's a business expense. That would come off their federal income tax. Tires, fuel, repairs to trucks, that's all a number one right off the bat gets written off their income tax. So you'd kind of be taking a little bit of that tax money that goes to Washington and diverting it to the state of Connecticut. And I really don't think it's unreasonable for it. It's a business expense, and trucks do an enormous damage to our roads and bridges. And there should be some way, shape, or form that we get compensation. Not all trucks buy fuel in the state. There's tolls in New York. There's tolls in New Jersey, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. It's a free state. And I really think in some way, shape, or form, Connecticut should get something out of some of these trucks for driving through here.
Yeah, no, Gene, I hear what you're saying. You know, the truckers will argue that they already pay much higher taxes to be in Connecticut. I know that I've had truckers on before, and they can talk at length about it. But, the vast majority of people that are going to end up paying tolls are people who live in Connecticut. I mean, even though we think about, the interstates, of course there is some interstates. But look what happened with Rhode Island, right? Rhode Island is admittedly a small state, but they got their toll in. Yes. But $7 million? I mean, that's not a lot of money when you consider that they're erecting an entirely new revenue source. Now, to be fair to Rhode Island, what they've said is, now that we've got $7 million from this gantry, we're going to be erecting them in many more places all over the state. I don't know, Gene. I'm a little bit gun shy of erecting an apparatus to collect tolls in Connecticut. I think it's I think it's a little bit of a camel nose under the door myself. A little bit.
I give a lot of credit to the Republican Party this week for coming up with an alternate plan. That was very well done. The only downfall to it is the word borrowing. Borrowing has to be repaid no matter whether, even if it's
interest-free. No, this is not borrowing. This is dipping into, it's different. So the rainy day fund is already there. It's money.
Right.
And so we're not borrowing from the rainy day fund. We're using part of the rainy day fund.
Well, it was my understanding they were going to, and I may have it all wrong, but I thought they would take a portion of the rainy day fund and they would pay down their pension obligations that is at a higher interest rate. So we would be more debt free and be able to afford low interest borrowing from the government at a smaller percentage.
Well, it's a refinance of existing debt, but it's also a pay down. It's a pay down and a refinance. So it's like you're two for one, right? Where you can pay down a little bit of your debt and then refinance your house to get rid of your credit cards. It's sort of like that.
There's two factors that scare me is that if we don't conclude something that will satisfy Governor Lamont, I mean, we're going to fix the roads and bridges. I don't know where he would go if he doesn't, if we don't satisfy him on the tolls. We're going to pay Connecticut residents one way or the other. And he's already buried us in year, you know, with a whole bunch of taxes that we never accepted or never expected. And another factor, I work in the construction industry. Connecticut, if you ever get a chance, look up, and we have one of the highest administration costs per mile of road.
I know that. It's huge.
And we've got to do a better job at some of the projects, the way we spend the money. You know, we're not getting enough, say, bang for the buck. You know, and I'm in the work in the construction industry, and I got to say that, you know, contractors should be DOT's best friend, because we come up with ways to get a job done quicker, and a partnering spirit is better to some type of a value engineering or system where the contractor who was awarded the job is your partner, in ways that we could shave off dollars or anything that we could do, because money's hard to come by, and we got to make it go farther. The money, if a project is $1 million in Connecticut, it ends up being $1.5 million when you add on all the administration costs and the testing and all the inspection and stuff that comes with it, which is important. You know, we don't want a bad job. We want a job that will last a long time. I really think someone should overlook that system and try to make this money go a lot farther than it is right now.
Gene, I think you raised probably the most important elephant in the room. There was a recent study, and I read it and I spoke about it on the air, that I think Connecticut came in maybe the top three in the country as the most costly per mile in the entire country, but by far, not even by, I think Jersey was number one, and then was Connecticut, and then like everybody else, and then maybe Florida, and everybody else was way down per cost per mile. There is something essentially wrong with our system as it exists. And if we're going to spend all this money, no matter whether it's one or 20 billion, we've got to drill down and find out where our money's going.
Well, we do. Absolutely. You know, good points to Department of Transportation work is it's Buy American. It is money that recirculates in the economy, employment of they're very fair about employment. They're very fair about local residents, disadvantaged businesses. That part of it is very good. But, you know, some of the testing and the format for the paperwork and the testing that's created, there's better systems, you know, and that should be really looked at close. So when we get this influx of money, we're going to do it. We really try to get a long run out of it, not just a couple of quick projects. And oh, that one went over 30%. And you know, another thing that happens too is, and I'll give you an example. Right now, a lot of that work that's being done on the Mixmaster, it's a temporary repair. It's going to buy us residents in the state 25 years till a permanent fix is remedied and it's built. But that design of what's going on right now was done so long ago that when they designed that job and they put it to bid, the scope of the work was at a certain point. As they dig into this work that was designed maybe 10 years ago, more deterioration has happened, more things have happened. So you know, if it was going to be so many square feet of deck replaced, it more has to be done because it's that time lapse of
where's
design
the mix
and approval.
Master? Gene, where's the Mixmaster?
That's the Waterbury junction of Route 8 and 84.
Okay.
That's a very complicated, one of the biggest infrastructure headaches in the state of Connecticut.
Oh,
right now.
I've been around. It's ugly, too.
Yeah.
It's very ugly.
Yeah, it's a very difficult situation. But my point is that, you know, they'll design a project today in 2019.
Yeah,
that probably won't get to the bidding process for 5, 6, 7 years. A lot changes in that length of time.
That's
and,
a good point.
You know, the scope of work was built on what they found today. And when they go to do it, more problems have erupted. And
let me ask you, Gene, since you seem so knowledgeable about this, what about the composition of putting a little bit more rubber in with our concrete? I raise that because one of the Accorda Scientific Excellence Award winners had done a high school project in which he was able to show that if we have rubber versus asphalt, that the road cracks less, lasts longer, is much easier on tires. It's just a better quality, longer lasting road. What do you think about that?
One thing here in the Northeast, we face severe weather. You'll have 95 degree days. 6 months later, you've got 10 below zero days. That just doesn't make, you know, that ruins concrete and asphalt. The temperature change, the ground freezing, but
it cracks like mad.
Another situation that pops up, and you got a good point there, because there are. We put down, I don't know how many tons of asphalt per year, and we mill up the existing asphalt, and we're creating this somewhat of a controlled substance that's hard to get rid of. Recycling is a great thing, but we're almost torn between Department of Transportation and DEEP, because Department of Transportation welcomes, to an extent, recycled products, but technically some of the products that they accept, some of the levels of the, say, controlled substances exceed what DEEP accepts. So
I see.
I worked on Steel Point, and that was a brownfield site, and we had a lot of problems. We were torn between the two agencies, especially on a brownfield site.
Interesting.
That normally the state accepts recycled asphalt. Well, you couldn't use it. So that's something that's got to be looked at, because when we don't recycle these products, we dispose of them, and it's every project, the dollars that go into disposal of controlled materials and contaminants in the ground, and the asphalt we rip up, the concrete, is a big factor in the job. So if there's a way to reuse it, but I think we've got to, it kind of falls under, and this will spark up a lot of opinion, but, you know, Donald Trump's easing up restriction a little bit. And we really got to get to the table, and we got to compromise on something. So some of the considered levels of contamination are parts per million and per billion. It's not something that, and with all that that's going on in the town of Fairfield, it's raised all kinds of problems. But it's a very, very minute part that you'd have to eat it for years to really be a real, real health hazard. But we want to be safe, and be safe for our children and the public.
Gene, this is a great conversation. I think I'm going to have you on as a guest. I want to thank you for calling, Gene from Stratford.
Okay.
Thanks for being so knowledgeable and sharing your knowledge with us.
Well,
appreciate
you. You do a great job. Out of everybody that does it, you got your facts in order good. I enjoy listening to you.
Thank you, Gene. Thank you so much.
Take care.
It's 10:35. We're going to have to take a little commercial here and let you know about all the wonderful businesses in our community that sponsor the show and that sponsor WICC 600. But when we return, a conversation with Dr. Julian Ford, let's talk a little bit about how we can recognize the signs and symptoms of trauma and those that are closest to us, and then what to do about it. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the show. You know, in my other professional capacity as a probate judge, every now and then I have the great pleasure of being able to sit in an audience to learn from people who know a lot more than I do about a lot of things. And our next guest, Dr. Julian Ford, came to a seminar and talked about the signs and symptoms of trauma, particularly in children. And I was so impressed and I was so moved that I followed up and said, you know what, Dr. Ford, you need to share this with our audience. Julian Ford is a board-certified clinical psychologist and tenured professor at UConn School of Medicine, as well as School of Law, where he is the principal investigator and director of two treatment and services adaptation centers in the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. Who thought we would have such a thing? The Center for Trauma Recovery and Juvenile Justice and the Center for the Treatment of Developmental Trauma Disorders. Dr. Ford is the president of the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies. He's published over 250 articles and book chapters, as well as 10 books. And he joins us now. Hello, Dr. Ford, and welcome to the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Judge Wexler. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you, but can you call me Lisa? Would you mind calling me Lisa?
Okay, for today I'll call you Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, Dr. Ford, I want to begin with this. Can you define what is trauma and how is trauma distinct from other psychological conditions?
Absolutely. Well, trauma is both an experience and some reaction. So a traumatic event is an experience that involves a threat to a person's life or witnessing someone else who's experiencing a threat to their life, which could be a very serious accident or injury, could also be an assault or violence or war. So basically trauma, when we talk about trauma, we're talking about not medical trauma, although that is one aspect, but psychological trauma is essentially a situation where your life essentially passes before your eyes. And it may be something happening to you, or it may be something happening to someone that you actually, that you see, and you might be perfectly safe, or someone you know. And then the reactions, Lisa, are just what you would expect. There's initially, there's a reaction of shock and disbelief, because none of us really expect that these kinds of life threats are going to happen in our lives. Even people who live in war-torn countries are still shocked by the immediacy when trauma strikes directly in their lives. So the shock reaction is the first reaction, but then there are a number of reactions that are basically the body's way of protecting us, because when you experience that kind of a threat, then your body basically says, okay, don't let this ever happen again without being aware of it. And so what we find is that people have what's called post-traumatic stress, or it can be a post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And that involves having memories or reactions to reminders of traumatic experiences that are just very upsetting and that kind of intrude. They come up when you least want them, just when you're trying to enjoy your life or pay attention to your work or to school. And they just sort of force their way in and create a sense of, okay, it's all happening all over again, even when you know it's not. When that happens, then the additional set of symptoms is, naturally, people who experience these kinds of unwanted, intrusive memories, the most natural thing to do and the healthiest thing to do is just try to avoid them.
Sure.
Or avoid anything that will trigger them.
Right.
But unfortunately, the more you try to avoid a memory or a thought, the more that you're thinking about it, and so it actually becomes a vicious cycle.
So we're chatting with Dr. Julian Ford, 203-333-9422. Call me at 203-333-9422. That's our number if you'd like to ask Dr. Ford a question. He is a world-renowned expert on trauma. I have a feeling you may have a question or two for him. So, Dr. Ford, so the reliving again and again, and this idea that when we want to push away terribly painful or intrusive thoughts, we can't help ourselves. Is this something that will come to us in dreams, or are we not talking about in dreams? We're talking about being awake and having these intrusive thoughts be with us no matter what.
Well, you got it, Lisa. It's both. It definitely can happen in dreams. And what we know is that the dreams often take the form of nightmares that aren't specific to the traumatic event itself, but have the same kind of sense of being threatened or trapped or harmed or in harm's way. So, yeah, this is something that can happen 24/7, unfortunately, awake and asleep.
And what happens to us if we've experienced a trauma and we don't treat it immediately after the trauma occurs?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that most people, even without treatment, do recover from these kinds of terrible memories and the sense that you just have to avoid them at all costs. People have lots of resources. They talk with friends. They talk with faith advisors. They go on with their lives. They realize that they can make things safer again in their lives. Most people are able to recover, but most people, however, don't ever, in fact, no one ever gets rid of the memories. You cannot erase memories. So what happens very often is that people will recover very well, often on their own, and then another stressor will happen, something in their lives, and it doesn't have to be a trauma. It could be something like a divorce, or it could be a positive thing like having a child or getting a new job. When stress kind of activates the body's inherent defense system, that can trigger those memories all over again, and it can happen years or even decades after the trauma. And it's not because there's anything wrong with the person. It's just because the memory is still there. And
buried.
When that sense of threat
buried.
Comes up again,
yeah.
It can just pull it right back up. So that's why we do think the treatment is important. But I just want to tell you, we never want to start the treatment like in the first day or two.
No?
Want to give people at least a few days to just acclimate. Of course, we want people who've gone through a trauma to have support, to be safe if they need medical treatment, to get that. So all that is definitely important. But the treatment itself, which really involves going back and working through, thinking through, and coming to kind of an understanding of what has happened to you, basically, we call it memory processing, but it's just basically going back and figuring out what happened and how you can go on with your life. We don't want to start that until at least several days after the trauma has occurred. And sometimes it's not even something that needs to be done until a month or two or even 6 months after. But it's when those memories start to just kind of intrude and when you just can't seem to put them away, whether you're asleep or awake, that's when it's really important to think about getting treatment.
We're chatting with Dr. Julian Ford, who is a world-renowned expert on trauma, at 203-333-9422, in case you want to ask a question. So let me ask you this. My mom, who is now in her 80s, she started about 10 years ago to talk about things that traumatically happened to her when she was a teenager. And she kept talking about them and talking about them all the time. I didn't hear about them for 50 years. And now I hear about them all the time. And it's the same one or two episodes of being molested on the way, coming home from school one day, and also as a young secretary in an office when her boss put his hand up her skirt. And these are memories that were suppressed for so many years, but now they're not. And they torture my mother. She talks about them all the time. So, Dr. Ford, what can I do? How can I help my mom?
Well, first of all, Lisa, you're describing something that is not uncommon, and it's not that people who, as they grow older, always remember traumatic memories, but at that point in life, when one is starting to more look back rather than look forward,
Yeah. It's
natural in the life review process to then kind of identify, you know, what are the moments that are of most importance to me? Some of them are going to be really wonderful and positive, and those are the good things to absolutely hold on to and enjoy. When the memories are troubling and when they've been suppressed, as you say, often for decades, then what's happening is that your mother is probably trying to basically figure out how did this happen to me? What can I do about it now?
Yeah.
And she's probably trying to go back and essentially replay the experience and make it come out different. And we know you can't do that, but what you can do and what we do in treatment as well, but this is something that a family member can do without being a therapist and
right.
not trying to do therapy,
right.
is just basically when your mother talks about those experiences, perhaps what you can do is just ask her, so, Mom, you know, how did you handle that? And how did you make sure that you could kind of go on and just do everything that you've done in your life? What that does is that kind of shifts the focus from, oh, my gosh, this was such a terrible thing and I've never gotten over it, to, you know, actually it was a terrible thing and we're not minimizing that, but I did get over it because I've gone on with my life.
Yeah, and it was such a good life.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, we're not saying, you know, oh, Mom, just stop talking about the bad stuff and
right.
just focus on the good. No, it's really important for the person who's doing this, in this case your mom, to be able to think clearly about that memory and not try to shut it out
okay.
or push it away, but not to dwell on it as something that just never kind of got resolved.
Right, because she felt so powerless and so upset and she didn't tell anyone
exactly.
and all of that. All right, let's go to a caller. We've got Hafat from Bridgeport. Hello, Hafat. This is the second time I'm hearing from you. Welcome back to the show. Hello.
Thank you, Lisa. Good
to
be again with you. Yes, I have a question to ask the doctor because, you know, I've been going through this kind of a thing from I was 7 years old and never recognizing it that it's something that happened that, like what the doctor talked about here, because I was just seven when I was a star, so-called, in the school, two grade combined together as a 7 year old, to show you where I was when I went to elementary school at the age of seven. I did not know that I had gone to kindergarten before I went to school at 7 years old. Yeah, I have no knowledge that I had gone to kindergarten. So it's when I went at 7 years old to elementary, I recognized that all the other kids them in school, I became their teacher within the two grades. So
are you the only one that went to kindergarten? I'm confused, Hafit. What are you trying to say?
Oh, well, what I'm saying, I didn't know before I was 7 years old who I was. And when I went to elementary at 7 years old, with the teacher, you know, her job is to teach two different grades combined. I became the teacher, teaching what the teacher is supposed to be doing, meaning on the blackboard, teaching the two grades combined together, including she got one daughter. And I'm the teacher. She wrote what needed to be taught for X amount of period of time. And I was the one up there teaching the two grades combined.
Was this traumatic for you, Hafat? Was this a trauma?
No, that was the wings under my wings.
Okay.
When she put me in that position.
Do you have a question for Dr. Ford?
Yes, I was flying then. But shortly after that, the teacher had to leave to go to a different, like from Stanford to Hartford. Her husband get transferred, which was in the minister. So she got to get a transfer from the school. And she asked my parents to let me move with them. And my parents said no. And from that day, what I was doing at that age, every day I go to school, nobody explained anything to me or so forth or so fifth, you know, or to help me to understand what's going on. I would be in school, and all I'm doing or I'm there doing is thinking, I'm wondering where they're at or where she's at. And I never recuperate.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you had this trauma at age 7 of being separated from your favorite teacher who celebrated you and who made you a star. And after that, you couldn't learn?
I become a dummy.
A dummy.
I put it that way.
Listen
a
to
dummy
that.
Because
wow.
I was in class. And like I said, all my attention and all I'm doing is thinking about where she's at, where they at, and so forth. And
wow.
I have nobody to talk to me. And like I say, I was 7. I leave school then at the age of, say, 15, 16, as a dummy, meaning I went in as a star, and when I left, I was a dummy.
Okay, let's hear what Dr. Ford has to say. Thank you, Hafat. Stay on the line. Let's hear what the doctor has to say.
Yes, well, I think what Hafat is describing is a combination of things that are important for us to understand. First of all, as a 7-year-old, he was quite remarkably precocious and was able to do things well beyond his capacity, well beyond the capacity we would expect. So he was a teacher at 7, and that's just a wonderful example of how resilient and how amazingly competent kids can be. Sometimes we don't even think about that. And then he had a major loss, as you said, Lisa, and having that teacher go away, it would not be what I would consider a trauma, but it was a major loss. And the difference is that it changed Hafat's life, but it didn't threaten his life. So what he's describing is really something very related to traumatic stress, and that's complicated bereavement or grief.
Okay.
So and
wow.
grief can have a very similar kind of an effect where you can end up just thinking about that person who you miss and wishing that they were here and feeling really alone because they're not here and there's no one to talk to. And that is different than post-traumatic stress, but it's very related. And very often, Lisa, when people experience traumatic events, when they experience a threat, they also often experience a loss. And that combination of traumatic grief, then what you're doing is you're trying not to remember the frightening or the traumatic or the threatening experience, but you're trying to remember the person who's lost, and so that can be especially complicated. So I'm really glad for that example because it highlights that grief and traumatic stress are related but different, and when they're combined, they are really, really a big challenge.
Hafat, thank you for the call. Dr. Ford, will you stay with us? We have to go to some messages. We'll be right back.
Sure.
We're chatting with Dr. Julian Ford, a preeminent specialist in the area of trauma. Call me at 203-333-9422. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. We're chatting with Dr. Julian Ford. Dr. Ford is a preeminent researcher and lecturer and therapist in the world of trauma. And he is both a professor at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine as well as at the School of Law, which is a whole other conversation and interview. Dr. Ford, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lisa.
203-333-9422 if you'd like to call. So I would like to know, because this was such an important part, I thought, of listening to you, how do we recognize the symptoms of a child who has been exposed to trauma? What are some of the more common behaviors that we would see?
Well, we often will see anxiety, but that's not the only symptom. Kids who are anxious, by the way, are not necessarily trauma survivors,
mm-hmm.
but that is certainly one possibility, and sometimes that gets overlooked in just zeroing right in on the anxiety and treating that. Another set of symptoms have to do more with just feeling really discouraged and even depressed. So even though depression also is not only caused by traumatic stress, it certainly can be one of the results. And with kids, what we also see is sometimes kids who've experienced trauma, they show it through acting out. They're more impulsive. Sometimes they're even kind of oppositional. And one of the things we're really concerned about in the field is we don't want kids who are basically reacting to try to protect themselves, even though they may not be in danger right now. But again, once the body kind of goes into an alarm state and the child or the adult is experiencing a sense of threat, then they can actually take that sense of threat and being unsafe into situations where they actually are safe and react as if there was great danger. And sometimes those reactions look like anger or impulsivity or just being disrespectful. And that can get kids into some pretty significant trouble. In fact, even as one of the centers that I work with focuses on, that can get them even into the juvenile justice system. And we're really working hard to make sure that when kids are having difficulty with anger or acting out or impulsivity, that we pay attention to the fact that they may actually be having traumatic stress reactions. And they're not bad kids, but they may be kids who've had some bad things that have happened to them.
So if you're a kid and you've witnessed a lot of physical abuse in your home, you know, what we call domestic violence, and you've grown up with that kind of trauma again and again and again, and you feared for your physical safety before you can remember there was such a thing, your brain was so traumatized. Is there any hope for you, Dr. Ford? Can you ever be normal? Can you ever be well adjusted?
Absolutely. There is lots and lots of hope. Now, again, you can't erase the memories, but the important thing is that, as we were talking about with the example with your mother, memories are...
You've only got a few seconds, Doctor.
Okay. Memories can be shifted so they don't focus only on the threat, but they focus on how you are able to handle it and go on with your life.
So
that's what we do in treatment.
What we do in treatment is we try and have people tell themselves good, healthy messages about how they can cope.
And how they've been successful and how they have come through experiences, even though they have been painful.
Dr. Julian Ford, thank you so much. In the next hour, we'll go to the impeachment proceedings, and we'll also chat with Countess Luanda Lesseps of the Real Housewives of New York City. Stay tuned.